Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial.
And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 190, all about Europe and the Euro. We're going to talk with our good friend Das, who is the author of Traders, Guns, and Money. Every time he's on, you all give me great emails saying, get him back on. So we do as often as possible. From down under, Das, how are you? You're in Australia now, right?
Yes, I'm hiding. I'm hiding from Europe and the Northern Hemisphere. It's very funny.
Yeah, in between all the Aborigines.
One of our central bankers went to the Jackson Hole confab with the Kansas Fed. And when he came back, his remark was he was just relieved to get out of A, Jackson Hole, and B, from all these central bankers who were all talking gloom and boom, because we here have a festival of complacency at the moment.
Yeah, well, you know, you still have a good amount of, we'll call it materials and natural resources that back up. You know, you have money where the mouth is, whereas that's a real problem for much of the developed world, isn't it?
Indeed. I don't think the Irish have anything backing up their economy, and not even Guinness, I don't think, anymore.
Let's talk about that. You and I have talked about this from some time. You had said, I think, good 6 months ago that the summertime we're going to start to see a lot more percolate again. And we did see, of course, Greece start to come up with all sorts of problems. And let me tell you my take on this. I think singly, in a very simplistic way, I could say that the central bankers and the politicians, and I'm just focusing on Europe for a moment, are out-and-out liars. And why I say that is this. It started with the whole discussion from Trichet really saying that there was nothing wrong for a long period of time. And at the same time, we had Papandreou, whatever how you say his name, over from Greece constantly saying that they didn't have any need for a bailout. Then all of a sudden, yes, they do. And then we have the bankers, Lenihan and a couple of guys over from Ireland saying basically, hey, you know what? Everything's fine. We don't need a bailout. And then all of a sudden, within 2 days, as if they were forced to do so, they were forced to take a bailout that wasn't just a few shekels. It was in the close to, well, we still don't have exact numbers and we won't have that for a while, but, you know, possibly $100 billion. And is this all an act just to make sure that markets don't destabilize? Is that what they're doing so they can't, you know, they won't say anything negative? Is that the point?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's all been a gigantic confidence trick, because I think at the end of the day, I don't think the policymakers, whether they're in Europe or elsewhere, really have the tools to deal with this. And in the end, I think they gambled on growth and inflation. And when that hasn't worked, they really don't have very much else that they can do. So they're now jawboning the markets, trying to convince them. And clearly, you know, when you've got a problem as deep-rooted as this, you know, just talking and trying to bolster people's confidence and gee people up, it's basically like you're a featherweight fighting against a heavyweight, and you're the manager in the corner saying to your fighter, and he's bleeding to death, you go in there, just one punch, it'll do it.
Yeah, exactly.
And he sort of stood there.
He's looking weak, he's looking haggard, don't worry.
Yeah, he looks overconfident.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the issue with Ireland, which is the latest. Now, this is the way I see it, in somewhat of a, I guess the dominoes. It starts with Greece, and Greece was the tip of the iceberg. And let's forget about Iceland for a second here, but the new tip of the iceberg was Greece. Then, of course, Ireland, because of their banking woes. We have then potentially Portugal, which has just been an outright mess for a long time. Italy's somewhere in there. And then Spain is the final big daddy, because there's not enough money to actually bail out Spain with the current amount that's been allocated. Two things I have a question. First of all, I never understood something. With the European zone coming up with, round number, $1 trillion to try to backstop the euro and to stabilize the euro, by then spending that on bailouts of the various countries and banks and the issues involved, I never really understood how that process of spending money in the form of what's called stimulus or the form of printing money actually helped the euro. It would seem to me that that would weaken the euro, but that wasn't what initially happened.
Well, I think it's you got to go back to a fundamental issue. I think the whole of the world essentially had a policy in after 2008 and early 2009 was just to basically spend and stimulate the economy. Now, if you've got a government which has a reasonably healthy balance sheet, you can do that. The problem is all the European countries didn't have healthy balance sheets. They have a culture which over the last quarter of a century and maybe more has consisted of what I call the transfer economy, where effectively they've spent more than they tax. So under those circumstances, they've had a lot of debt anyway. Now, what I think becomes very interesting is the way, as you called it, the dominoes are falling. The problems are different. Greece is different to Ireland for a whole bunch of reasons. But the commonality in all of this is these countries have, for different reasons, been living beyond their means. And effectively, the Irish problem is exactly a different version of the Greek problem in the sense they can't really raise money from commercial sources because all the commercial sources are saying, well, guys, you can't pay us back, so why would we lend you money? So the Europeans then put together this strange thing called the European Financial Stability Fund, which is a completely dubious proposition at best, because what it consists of is a mutual debt pact between all the Eurozone countries where they're effectively going to guarantee each other to the tune of, as you said, about $1 trillion. And I think what they were hoping for was that the sheer shock and awe of the very large number would convince the markets that they were serious. Except it's such a stupid plan anyway, because you've got Ireland guaranteeing Greece and Greece guaranteeing Ireland, which is not going to work. And then, of course, this facility is actually not going to be funded by the individual countries. What is going to happen is this vehicle is going to go out and issue debt. And wait for it, they got themselves rated AAA. And when they got themselves rated AAA, which is crucial to them being able to raise money, the rating came out in September this year, and when you read the S&P and the Moody's and the Fitch's ratings right up, they basically say, look, we're rating it AAA provisionally on the basis that we don't expect them to actually ever have to issue debt, which is kind of weird. I read that sentence about three or four times going, I'm sorry, what does this mean? They're not going to issue debt, then why do you need a AAA rating? So this whole facility has been there as a little confidence trick in the background, but effectively markets have a way of calling time on things. And markets don't believe any of this. So they've now decided to test it. And Ireland, to be very honest, was just unfortunate. It just happened to be the first in line. As you correctly point out, it's going to go to Portugal, it's going to go to Spain, and probably to Italy. And the problem is, once you get past Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, you're talking about countries which are too big to save and too big to fail. Because Spain has debt of over $1 trillion. And if we get to Italy, which I suspect we will, that amount is going to be about $2.3 trillion. And there's just no way anybody's going to be able to bail them out. So we're now into this very dangerous process of escalation where effectively we're going to see the whole issue of debt brought to a surface in a different way. And this is where the next phase of the crisis is going to come about. And it's actually quite a scary scenario, because there's now nowhere left to run, nowhere left to hide.
So no matter what is happening in terms of the companies, corporate balance sheets being bettered because of the low interest rates that are available to them, the higher ratings they've gotten, et cetera, is going to really help this, because we're talking about the rock falling from a much higher place. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the corporate sector, you're absolutely correct, looks to me in much, much better shape, because they have basically reduced their debt, they're actually quite profitable because they've cut costs hugely. And also, as you say, low interest rates helps them. But overall, if demand isn't growing, companies have an interesting life cycle, because if demand isn't growing, you don't need to invest. Your working capital requirements fall. So you become very cash rich. And we've seen examples of people giving back the money to shareholders like IBM, which has buoyed the stock market quite a bit. But there's now a complete disconnect between the stock market and the broader public sector, where the public sector is largely insolvent. It's like having a very good house in a neighborhood which is on fire. Eventually, the fire is going to get to
right,
you.
Right. Or for that matter, the nicest house in a neighborhood of ugly houses. Either way, you know what I mean? That doesn't mean your house will stay the value. But let's go back a second. Let's just back it up. Let's go back to Greece for a second. Something's been troubling me. I think the fire that you talk about that started with Ireland, it really started with a hint a couple of weeks, 3 weeks back, that Austria was balking at putting any further money into a black hole. When Greece was again starting to say, hey, wait a minute, we didn't make our budget numbers. And once again, the prime minister of Greece is throwing out all sorts of, you know, frankly, they're lies. I mean, I don't think there's any way to sugarcoat it. Lies about how they're going to meet their budget by a certain point. They're going to bring back down their deficit and debt to GDP down to a certain level that's required by the Eurozone's basic, fundamental charter. And Austria said, you know what? You don't do what you say you're going to do. We're not going to give you money. I'm thinking, well, boy, that makes sense. I mean, why should you keep on giving money to a country that is not putting their end of the bargain up for whatever reason? So that kind of stoked some concern. And then right on the heels of that, probably within about a week or so, we got the Ireland situation that really happened. Let's go back to Greece. Is Greece still in the same shape as it was before the bailout? I mean, just is this a to use that phrase that's being used all too often, just kicking the road slightly down the road for Greece, and they're going to be coming back for more?
I think you're right. The Greek package was conditional upon them meeting certain IMF targets. And the IMF came in and did what the IMF always do, which says you've got to increase taxes, you've got to cut spending. Now, the Greeks have, to their credit, made some progress. But they had a target. They had to get their budget deficit down to about 8% by the end of 2010. And they have failed. And that's exactly why Austria said, well, basically, we weren't going to give them the money. The Austria then, after I think a fair bit of leaning from other members of the European Union, conceded, and they actually made the payment. Now, the critical thing here is, and this loops back to the first part of your question, is that was one catalyst, but there was two other catalysts which are very, very crucial. The other catalyst was Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, who in one of those wonderful summits that the European Union have, said, look, we have to make the European Financial Stability Fund, which only goes till 2013 anyway, longer. We have to make it a permanent, like the European and Monetary Fund or something like that. But she made it conditional on something which most people hadn't anticipated, which is that the taxpayers alone wouldn't bear the burden. What that meant is if a country gets into trouble, the people who've lent to that country, which is the banks, the bondholders, everybody, has to share the pain, which effectively means senior bondholders and senior lenders who are expecting to get 100 cents in the dollar back for places like Greece and Ireland and Portugal and Spain were not going to get that back. And that caused enormous concern. Now, the third leg to this horrible story was the European Central Bank itself. Now, what has not been talked about is what happened post-Greece. Effectively, everybody thinks that these economies are able to finance themselves, but that's actually a barefaced lie, because this is what's actually happening. So countries like Spain, countries like Ireland were issuing debt, and everybody was clapping themselves on the back saying, oh, here's a successful auction, here's a successful auction, because, you know, they wanted to sell a billion, you know, there were demand for 3 billion. What most people didn't focus on was what was going on. And what was going on is Spanish banks were buying Spanish debt, and then they were taking that piece of paper to the European Central Bank and saying, I own this piece of Spanish bank. Can you lend to me against that? And the ECB had lent, the European Central Bank, had lent a massive amount of money. And Jean-Claude Trichet started to get very, very concerned. This is the the president of the European Central Bank, he started to get very, very concerned. And they were starting to hit technical problems as well. The technical problem being the amount that they were lending was in excess of what they were allowed to lend. To give you some idea of the amounts we're talking about, in the case of Ireland, the amount is reckoned to be somewhere around $130 billion mm-hmm. that the ECB has directly or indirectly lent to banks holding Irish paper. Now, that means they've lent roughly 20% of their total book to a country which is 1% in population of the whole of Europe. And they've lent very large amounts to Portuguese, Spanish, and Greek banks. And Trichet, I think, started to get very concerned. So the coincidence of those three events basically came about at the same time, which triggered the Irish crisis. But taking it one step forward and taking the Greek example, for instance, one of the things that completely mystifies me is, okay, Ireland is going to get this money from the European Union, the IMF, and the IMF is already in there, who have come in to basically say what they need to be done. But Ireland has already done most of what the IMF would say, which is cut spending, increase taxes. They've already done all of that. And effectively, the Irish economy has actually gone into the deepest recession since the Great Depression because their economy shrunk by 20%. Their unemployment is in the mid-teens. Their budget deficit has gone from 7 to 14, and their government debt has gone from about 25 to over 100, partly because of the recession, but partly because their banking system is completely insolvent. So what really puzzles me is, okay, well, the IMF is going to come and do all of this, but like Greece, Ireland's not going to recover. So basically, under those circumstances, what's the way out? Because to me, the inevitability is this debt is not coming back. We can pretend all we like. It's not going to come back. So at some point in time, the banks are going to have to take these write-offs. And that's what the European Union was trying to do, was control when these losses emerge. They were trying to spread them out over time, but the markets have called time on that process. And now we risk a very destabilizing end to this crisis.
Okay, so let me just back up, because that was a lot of information there, but let me back up to this. So now, the big discussion has been, since Merkel talked about the potential for, as I guess it would be called, haircuts, right? On,
yes, that's right.
On that. See, sovereign debt, basically you're not supposed to get haircuts. You're supposed to be, that's the whole point of buying government-backed debt, that they have full taxing power and you know, the full power of the quality government behind them. Now, all these people were buying, whether it was banks, hedge funds, other sovereign nations, were buying the bonds, for example, in Spain, because they said, hey, what's the difference? They're getting a much higher yield on that, but they're backed by the full power of not only Spain, but also the ECB, essentially, because the ECB said they were going to back them up to $1 trillion, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what you're saying to me is that the fear now is, uh-oh, wait a minute, we don't have this natural guarantee. We may have to take haircuts in the future. Now, all of a sudden, we're going to bid this up even higher because we don't have the same insurance behind it. That's number one. Number two, with the fact that there are haircuts potentially out there, which I think is right, by the way, I think that, you know, if you invest in something, there is no free ride, frankly. There shouldn't be. There should be risk involved in any investment unless there is specifically said that there is no risk. And then again, it depends who the guarantor is, right? But now, by the Spanish lending, buying the debt from the Spanish banks buying the debt, now all of a sudden you have a double whammy. Now you have the banks lending on that, so they may lose on that, plus the potential to take a haircut. It's almost like they double levered themselves with that, don't you think?
That's right. It's exactly right. And the big problem is, I use the analogy that the whole of Europe now looks like a bunch of mountaineers scaling the Matterhorn who are sort of tied to each other, and one by one they're falling off. Mm-hmm. If only one falls off, the rest can hold it together. But if, you know, two fall off, three fall off, and a particularly fat man falls off, then you've got a major, major problem because you're basically all going to go down. And that's the problem that Europe finds itself in now.
So when let's talk about the CDS issue here, because I've been really fascinated by the fact that, you know, you have people buying CDS or insurance on sovereign debt, let's say, right? And, you know, the price is whatever the price is, and they're buying this insurance, but yet at the same time, we've had no defaults. There's been almost a concerted effort to make sure that a restructuring alone is not going to be available in such a way that a CDS will pay off, right? Have you noticed that?
That's correct. The CDS market is kind of an odd market because if you actually look at the volumes, on some of these sovereigns, that insurance market, it's tiny. But what it is it's become two things. Markets always like to push things around to get volatility to make money. And they can use the CDS market to push around the price of the debt of these countries. So they're using that as a way of pushing that around. Whether or not they're going to pay off or not is less of an issue for them because they're trading day by day. Because if they keep pushing and the fees for insurance for countries like Ireland, Portugal, Spain keep going up, they're going to keep making money. So that's basically the first thing. The second thing is this has a disproportionate effect because it's a headline figure, which now for Greece is around 12%, for Ireland is around 9%, Spain is now going up, Portugal is around 6%. So basically what it does is it makes it almost a self-fulfilling prophecy because none of these countries, because of the massive amount of debt they have, if they have to fund at those sorts of interest rates, they're not viable because they just can't. It takes too much of your gross domestic product to actually pay that. So it effectively makes it a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that's what markets are doing. So they're using that as almost the lever to try to achieve the end, which is to tip these countries over into going to the European Financial Stability Fund.
But even if that is the case, the CDS won't pay off, will it?
No, probably not.
That's the funny thing, that, you know, the CDS market, the way you make money, or theoretically, you know, that's the ultimate game, is for it to create some kind of a dissolution, a bankruptcy, of something that would trigger the CDS, right? But the CDS market is never really going to get paid off. Now, let me throw this at you. Let's throw out hypothetical. Let's say that Ireland does go bankrupt, and let's say all those CDS are out there. Maybe that was bought by sovereign nations to protect their bonds. Do you think that the CDS, if it was paid, will be able to be paid?
Well, first question you've got to ask is who's written this insurance?
Right.
And my suspicion is it's been written by a bunch of hedge funds, and it's been written by banks and other investors in those countries who are sort of going back to your point about double leveraging, that if the country goes bankrupt, we are screwed anyway, so we might as well earn something along the way, and we'll write some insurance on these. And basically what they're doing, which has always been the game in the CDS market to some degree, is that when you call on me to pay, I can't pay. So basically, under those circumstances, it's highly unlikely that there would be enough money in the system to pay for it. So it's kind of a strange world because it's surreal. It's like the wilderness of mirrors. You think you're getting something, you're not. And my view always has been on the CDS market on sovereigns. It's got nothing to do with actual default. It's trading the day-by-day changes in the pricing of the debt. That's what we see.
So it's more of a trade than it is actually insurance on the CDS on sovereign.
That's correct. That's exactly how it's
traded.
All right,
I can go with that. Because at the same time, I think the CDS on non-sovereign, on corporate debt, has almost been the same situation. I mean, how many CDS has actually paid off over time? I mean, a few. We had the Lehman payoff, right? We had Bear Stearns payoff. Now, what about the banks? I mean, Ireland is taking back and nationalizing a couple of banks, potentially. I think Allied Irish, right?
That's right.
Is that going to, I mean, I hate to keep on focusing on this, but does that trigger the CDS payment?
Well, I think in the case of the Allied Irish banks, being taken over by the government doesn't trigger it because the entity is still there and presumably it'll continue to actually pay its debts. Now, the critical thing, of course, is the trigger in all CDS contracts is either bankruptcy, which it won't be, or failure to pay.
Right.
And the failure to pay hasn't been triggered. And there is a technical provision called restructuring. It depends on when you did your CDS contract as to whether restructuring is an event or not. But it's highly unlikely this would be classed as a restructuring. So I don't think that's the issue. But the question of the banks is far more fascinating. And the real question on the banks is not so much the Irish banks. What most people haven't really focused on is these bailouts are not about bailing out Ireland, Portugal, Greece, or Spain.
Mm-hmm.
It's about bailing out the banks and the lenders. And people forget that in the case of the German and French banks, they have $1 trillion of exposure to these countries. And frankly, if they were to be called on that, in other words, to write off a substantial portion, they'd have a major problem. And I think this was always the end game for the European Union. They knew that. So what they were trying to do was do a couple of things. They were using the threat of default on these countries to firstly get the countries themselves to change their practices, to become more fiscally responsible and more, you know, get their economy into a shape where they could service some of this debt. The second thing is what they wanted the banks to do and the investors to do is to build up reserves, build up capital, so that when the haircut came, it would A, be smaller, and B, the markets would be in a better shape to actually cope with that. And I think that's where the 2013 sunset for the European Financial Stability Fund was set up. But the problem is they haven't been able to do either thing. The thing has, like all things in markets, gained the momentum and a life of its own, and it's now driving us towards the edge of a cliff at a rather large clip.
You know, this reminds me of something. You know, have you ever been out somewhere and you see a mother or a father trying to discipline their little child and say, okay, little Johnny, you do that one more time. Oh, wait, little Johnny, I'm going to count to three. I'm counting. One, two, stop. You got to stop what you're doing. Three, four. And they count up to like 100 and nothing gets done. That's kind of what's
exactly
going on.
What's happened. You know? That's exactly what happened. And there's another dimension here which is useful to talk about, because these are matters of national sovereignty as well. Because you have people whose living standards are being pummeled. I mean, people haven't focused on the fact that the Irish are going to cut the minimum wage. They're going to dilute all the living standards and the employment protections that they had under the European Union. And the Greeks are being asked to do the same. Now, people aren't going to necessarily just acquiesce to that process.
Yeah.
And if they don't acquiesce to that, you're going to get political turmoil. Now, it's clear the Irish government is going to fall in the new year because they're going to go to an election. But the national mood has changed. There was an interesting editorial in the Irish Times where they were referring to the Easter Rising against the British rule in 1916. And they said, was what the men of 1916 died for a bailout from the German Chancellor with a few shillings of sympathy from the British Chancellor on the side.
Right.
And you can see this sort of incipient nationalism. And that's going to make it very, very difficult for these countries to accept what they have to do. And I think you're going to see, we've already seen, obviously, civil strife and unions protesting, but that's going to become a much more European and a completely pan-European phenomena. So I'm not actually sure that some of the reforms that are necessary will be that easy to do politically.
Right.
And in Portugal, for instance, the government's very close to falling as well, and in Spain as well. So it's, and well, the Italian government is in a permanent state of collapse, so it doesn't really make any difference.
Yeah, but they have great wine, so just let's leave them out of this.
That's true. And they can always sell the Colosseum.
Right, exactly. Well, Greece so could
some
sell
Russian
some,
probably wants to buy it.
Greece could sell some islands, I figure, also. But you know what? The difference also in this recent Ireland situation was it wasn't just the EU that stepped up with some money, was it? We saw that England came up with a chunk of money. They have of the most to lose in the banks.
Absolutely. Their exposure, which is the English banks, is about $150 billion. And the George Osborne, who's the Chancellor of the Exchequer, or the Treasury Secretary in the UK, effectively, I think, contributed about $7 billion to this. And he was making it out to be all neighborly. But the fact of the matter is, if Ireland has a default and there's major losses to the UK banks, which are actually owned, a majority owned now by the government anyway, would have their own problems again.
Right.
So it's this networking effect of everybody being tied to everybody else. And that's becoming very, very much now a problem again, as we saw at the end of 2008 and early 2009.
So to kind of tie this together in terms of Ireland, the one other thing that is, I think, a very big and under-discussed matter is how are they going to collect the money to get to where they need to be? So we talked about higher taxes potentially and lower services, if you will. But the bigger issue here is that if back in the 2000s, early 2000s, Ireland was like the tech center of Europe. Do you remember that?
I do indeed.
And it was, you know, that was the place, the greatest minds, greatest thinking. It was like Ireland was, wow, it was kind of like Silicon Valley, you know, East, if you will. You know, Silicon Valley with a Guinness. And here's the thing, that so many companies still have a tremendous footprint in that area. For example, Microsoft. As one example, there's several other major companies. The question is, they have, or the point is, they have a very favorable tax benefit in Ireland. And the big overriding point here now, and the thought is, how much of a, even though they say they're not going to do this, of an increase in the taxes on foreign companies that are domiciled or not domiciled, but at least part of the company works in Ireland and has factories and offices and a major footprint there. Are they going to raise taxes on those? And what does that mean all the way back to the U.S. and to the companies here that have that.
You're absolutely correct, because in the first phase of Irish development, which was quite healthy, they used low taxes, which is 12.5%. And essentially what that did was create this huge, huge inflow of, as you say, the Microsofts of the world establishing the European base in Ireland. Now, this has now become problematic, because if they increase the taxes, then obviously there's a chance that, A, those companies will move to other countries which have more favorable tax rates, or alternatively, if they stay, their profits are going to be hit. But this also has become a central problem in the whole European Union bailout, because the French and the Germans are arguing, with some degree of correctness, that their taxes are like 25% on corporate earnings. They're saying, why can Ireland have lower taxes, which is inconsistent with us? And there's an attempt to make this a condition of any European Union facility. And so this actually creates a double problem for Ireland, which is in doing what the European Union and the IMF want, they make themselves completely uncompetitive, which is not going to help. But if they stay where they are, depending on what the growth rates in the world are, that because of their low tax rates, the chance of them actually bringing their budget deficit into control is basically almost impossible. And so they're talking instead, rather interestingly, about increasing the value-added tax, which is like a sales tax in Ireland. The problem with that is that's hugely regressive, because if everybody has to pay that, irrespective of income and so forth, that's hugely regressive and creates social tensions as well. So there's just no way that you can juggle all these balls and get out easily. So I think we're in for a very, very volatile and interesting little period ahead of us as all these issues have tried to be sorted. And I'm not terribly optimistic that they will be sorted in a sensible way.
Well, I mean, let's put a cherry on top of this and state the obvious. How stupid of it is it that a union of countries that are under the same currency that is supposed to have a unified front have different economic underpinnings? How stupid is that?
Well, I think Milton Friedman would be rejoicing in his grave because he pointed out the folly of this whole system, which you've correctly pointed out. And there's now two interesting strands in the European Union. One strand says, oh, no, this is an opportunity. It's a great historic opportunity for us to merge and basically have one fiscal policy, one monetary policy, one tax policy, one corporate law, everything. Now, that's basically what I would call the Europhiles. On the other side, people are saying, well, this whole experiment was stupid to begin with, and we actually need to go the other way. Now, that's really a political issue rather than an economic one, because the political comeuppance from unwinding some of these arrangements like the single currency would be just catastrophic. And, you know, to some extent, I think the French and the Germans do not want to give the Americans or the British the pleasure of saying those four most delicious words in the English language, I told you so.
Yeah.
So there's a huge amount of dynamics going on, but I think that's going to create enormous, enormous stress. And the risk here is that these problems just get more and more intractable, impossible to solve, and under those circumstances, we get a catastrophic breakdown, and that would be with Germany just basically taking their bat and ball home and saying, well, you know, you guys sort it out amongst yourselves. We're just leaving the euro because we can't hack this anymore because we have to pay the bills for everybody else. Everybody's having a great party, but I'm going to have to fill up the tab at the end of the night, and I'm not having a real good time, so good luck.
Well, actually, you read that piece I wrote some time ago in the whole discussion of why the European is I don't want to say doomed. It sounds so overly negative, but that probably is the right word. But, you know, what the problem with Europe is and why Europe all of a sudden looked like a bright spot and had to do with the, you know, their own version of driving down, if not the purposefully, but the driving down of the euro really helped out for a good measure the German manufacturing machine more than anyone else. And it still is, you know, Germany still has a high consumer confidence. I mean, you know, it's not as high as they want it to be. The manufacturing numbers still look a little, you know, still look pretty good. And, you know, you take them out of the equation and the rest of the area just looks like, you know, an island of itself. And Germany does look like the strong one. And I think that, you know, by what they've gotten themselves into over this time, they're going to have to, you know, do their best to straighten it out. Let's switch over, though, for a moment. And let's talk about the banks, the banking sector, because a few things recently came up that I found really fascinating. And that was, there was an announcement, you know, quote-unquote leak, that the potential was that the Fed was now going to consider allowing many of the banks to reinstate dividends and or increase dividends. And that really shot up the financial sector for about a day. And what came out of that was a that was the headline, that was the discussion, that was just, you know, it was very excited about that. But then on the backside, we heard that, but they may have to go through another stress test to look at their capital ratios to see if, and their tier one ratios, et cetera, to see if they qualify to do so. So in other words, another, whether it's a reasonable stress test or not, you know, do you think that that is something that is going to play out and that's going to be, you know, pressing them to do so? In the U.S., I'm talking about now, and then we'll talk about some of the Basel III rules that is looking for increase of capital ratios as well.
Well, I think the banking sector is fairly central to this, and for two reasons. One, if you look at the stock market improvement, a good chunk of that improvement was the banks recovering from, albeit, very, very low levels. The second thing is, if you look at the peak earnings in the S&P 500, which I think were in the low $80 per S&P unit, financial sector was a big chunk of that. It was like 40% of that. So it's crucial that the banking sector obviously recover that for the stock market value. The second thing is the creation of credit and the ability of them to lend is crucial to sustaining the economic recovery, weak though it is. So that's the first thing that we need to keep in mind. The next thing is, okay, well, the stress tests are very, very important for a couple of reasons. I think the Fed would like the banks to increase dividends because clearly Bernanke believes in the wealth effect. I mean, he was very clear when the quantitative easing rules were changed and announced. He said that he wanted the wealth effect, the stock market going up, so people felt good and basically spent money. And obviously, if dividends increase from the banks and other sectors, that's obviously very healthy. So he's very, very keen to do that. But he's acutely, acutely aware that the banks are not as healthy as they look. And there's two dynamics to that. One is their assets, because effectively, they have, in the last few quarters, reported very good earnings, but they've developed a new profit center. It's called bad debt. Because they posted these huge reserves, they've now reduced those reserves, but it's not a recurring item. So basically, he's concerned that their bad debt reserves are not sufficient relative to the economic outlook. So he wants to make sure of that. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if you look at their core earnings, they're extraordinarily weak because their investment banking revenues collapsed because trading volumes collapsed. But if you look at their consumer lending as well, because they're not lending as much, they're not actually making money. So he's very, very concerned that they now don't have a second round of weakness and come back to the Fed and say, well, we need more money. And so all of those factors are being played out. And the question is, you know, there are stress tests and there are stress tests. It just depends on how onerous they are and what scenarios they test. For instance, the Europeans, when they did the stress test, as we talked about last time, was essentially a non-event.
Oh, that was
they
a joke.
Made sure
that
it was fast. That was a joke.
Yeah.
So it depends on what they do. But I think Bernanke would be very, very keen to ensure that there's no problems in the banking sector going forward, but also to make sure that if the banks can, they can basically start to increase dividend flow to enable people to have income to spend. He's very, very concerned about that. But that leads to the second part, which is really the Basel II, because central banks are talking through both sides of their mouth. Because on one side, they want the banks to pay dividends, they want them to lend. On the other side, they want to tighten the controls on banks through this thing called Basel III. So they need to make up their mind to some extent of which is the priority.
Yeah. Now, when we look at the banks for a moment and we look at the fact that they're not lending, a couple of things. First of all, lending has been coming up a bit, yes. And at the same time, we're seeing that even though people say you can't get a loan, if you look at the actual levels, the likelihood or their desire and the levels of what's the word I'm looking for? Their tests to see if you are able to get the loans have been brought down again somewhat to enable people to get loans. But, you know, the problem has been that the spreads, the amount that they earn over the money they're lending, in other words, the spread between what they're lending at and what they're paying on the money to get, has been really compressed over time. It's been compressed dramatically. Now, Bernanke comes out and he does this $600 billion deal, which is supposedly going to, you know, the whole idea was to bring down the long end of the curve, but yet he's hitting the center part of the curve, and he got exactly what he didn't want, was with a substantial increase in the long end of the curve rates. So you got a better, and whether they tried to do this or not, I don't know, but they got a better yield curve for the banks recently, but the spreads are still contracting.
Well, you're right. I think there's a huge problem because of the tools that the central bankers are using, which is zero interest rates and quantitative easing. They're very, very blunt tools for the actual refinement and the narrow focus that they want to get. Now, picking up on your first point, I think Bernanke, is fairly confused at the best of times, but at the moment he's more confused than usual because he said, well, if I can bring down the interest rates, then what I can do is effectively get people to refinance homes. Now, that misses a fundamental point. If you borrowed 80% of the value of your house, but your house has gone down by 40, 50%, there's no way you can refinance. Because if you refinance, even if the bank was willing to lend you 80%, it halves what you actually can borrow. So you have to find roughly half the loan amount to pay back, which nobody can do. Also, unless you have income certainty and job certainty, you're not going to basically go out and take new loans. So I think that was completely flawed, the thinking. But the second thing
is... By the way, let me interrupt. Was it flawed or just outright stupid? Because I'll tell you why. Usually and traditionally, you want about a 1% reduction in the price you're currently paying in order to make sure that the refinancing works with all the different fees and the doc stamps and all the different things. And there was no way that we were going to bring down the long end by 1% compared to where it was. It had been a 25% reduction in the long end, which is really based on what the mortgages are based on, no matter what he was going to do at this point. And if people, the second point is, if people could have refinanced at this point, wouldn't most people have taken advantage of it at the low rates that we saw already? So I don't, the two things, they don't make any sense to me.
No, I agree with you. It doesn't make any sense. And the last round of quantitative easing, which albeit was a little smaller, that only resulted, I think, in the long end coming down about 15, 20 basis points. So there's just no way it would have worked. So I think the best way, the charitable view of Bernanke would be that he thought it was worth a try. The uncharitable view would be that he really doesn't understand how this stuff works. So it's one view or the other, as you can take. But I think that's absolutely true. But the second problem with the interest rate policy that he's now got, or the quantitative easing problem, is the point that you made. He's buying the wrong end of the yield curve. And that's because he's got conflicting sort of agendas. One is he wants the rates to be low, but he wants to create inflation, which will automatically push up the long end of the yield curve.
Right, exactly.
It doesn't make sense.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense.
If you have inflation, you're going to have higher rates. I mean, that's the problem. The other point is, though, I'll tell you something. $600 billion, whether we think it's a lot or a little, it's a lot of money, okay? In the old days, this would have been all of the money. And in the last 5 years, it became just a smaller amount. But you know what? It did dramatic damage to the price of commodities on the upside.
Look, this is the real problem. The quantitative easing has had a couple of what I would call unintended consequences. The positive unintended consequence is the federal government now is in pretty good shape, because if they had the $1 trillion deficit in 2011, well, Bernanke has just bought $600 billion of that. So 60% of your budget deficit is actually funded, which is terrific. But the second thing is, if it succeeds in keeping interest rates down, and that's an open question, then theoretically it actually devalues the dollar, gives American exporters some export competitiveness, which is all healthy. But on the other side, as you correctly point out, what it does is set off this amazing bubble in commodities, because most commodities are traded in dollars. So what actually happens is the price of the commodity adjusts, because the guy who's selling the commodity says, hey, you're giving me dollars, and the dollars are worth less. But the problem here is that's triggering a massive, massive problem in Asia and in all the emerging countries, because they generally import a lot of commodities. So their inflation is going through the roof, and what this is going to do ultimately is start to damage growth in places like China, which until about a month ago I understood was going to basically drive the world into the next paradigm of wealth and well-being.
Yes.
So by damaging them, do you actually help yourself? That's the mystery. And what we've seen now is in China particularly, interest rates go up, and they're very, very concerned about the social consequences of higher food prices, and they're trying to bring in price controls, all of which will dampen growth, which is the last thing you want to hear in this environment. So the policies have a lot of unintended consequences.
I think that the step that went in the wrong direction here was all based on very flawed and very... underwhelming political will. The amount of political capital that had been used in the United States to put in the health care, the financial reform, whether or not it's going to be good or not, just at a moment, you know, we put that aside. But the amount of political pressure that was put in and the goodwill that was used up basically relegated us to the inability to put any good fiscal stimulus or fiscal plan, whether it's reducing taxes, whether it's postponing the Bush tax cuts, whether it's targeted stimulus in some area or not. It used it all up, and there's no way that we can get that. And the only thing left we have are these very blunt and very flawed instruments that the Fed can do outside of the boardroom, if you will, without any kind of consultation or any kind of approval requirements at all. And the problem is that I agree with you. It's causing a big problem, and I can really see, and there's another piece I wrote about I sent over to you, this I could definitely see the groundwork being laid for the potential for a stagflation environment in the U.S. It fits, even though statistically we don't have any inflation right now.
You're right. I think that's absolutely right. And it just goes to show that I think over the last 20 or 30 years, we've assumed that the central bankers and the policymakers have far more control of the economy than basically they do. And in creating a globalized world, one of the things that people haven't factored in is when you create these connections and interrelationships between different parts of the economy, everybody assumes somehow that's always a net positive. But obviously, under certain circumstances, those positives can become big, big negatives because you lose control of your ability to influence events. And I think what we're going to see is a really devastating problem in addition to stagflation, is countries become more and more concerned about external influences and close down their borders to some lesser or greater extent, which means basically the threat of trade wars or restrictions on free flow of trade. And we're starting to see that in a small way already, particularly with capital flows. Many, many countries have now basically put in place controls whereby foreigners can't bring capital into the country. It's places like Brazil, Chile, Thailand, Korea have all put these in place. And what they're trying to do is say to the U.S., really, is by making your rates very, very low, what you're doing is forcing people to seek higher returns elsewhere. And all this money is flooding into our relatively modestly sized markets. And they're hugely, hugely destabilizing. And we don't want it because we saw what this does in the 80s when we had the Latin debt crisis. We saw that in the 90s when we had the Asian debt crisis. So nobody wants that. And that's part of the problem. And I think there's a crucial speech here that William Dudley, who's the president of New York Fed, made. He made a pointed remark in just before the quantitative easing announcement that basically the constituency of the Federal Reserve System was the United States, which is a classic statement of beggar thy neighbor, which is he didn't care what happened in the rest of the world. He was trying to reflate the U.S. economy, which at one level makes perfectly good sense. But in a interconnected world, that's a very, very dangerous attitude to start with.
No, I agree. I totally agree with that. And I find that there was a piece done by Bloomberg in one of their Bloomberg briefs by, I think it was Catherine Daugherty. And she gave the top countries and the amount of protectionism campaigns or the protectionism items that were being created over the last several years. And they're numbering in the thousands because there's a lot of little bitties out there, whether it's a tax on rubber, whether it's, you know, no chicken imports, whether it's, you know, oil that would be beneficial to China from Brazil. Remember, they did that deal for like $35 a barrel. You know, that is a form of protectionism where they're making sure that you buy from them. And look what just happened with potash, where they're not being able to be bought by BHP Billiton because that was a Canadian level of protectionism in a way, right? They shut down the deal. The government shut down the deal, making sure that the potash, the fertilizer company for that's based in Canada, one of the biggest producer in the world, is going to stay in Canada. And I think this protectionism issue is going to rear its head, and it is rearing its head. And I think that the end play on all this is, that caution is very much needed to be played right now because corporate profits in the face of these headwinds could be a problem. But the other thing is that I think is really the most concerning to me is that over the last several months, and we'll say 4 or 5 months, the amount of movement on currencies has been unbearable to me. I don't mean unbearable bad. I mean unbearable that you have to actually put that in your equation now when you're investing. Because it used to be, and I say this a lot, you know, it used to be that, you know, you had a 1% currency swing, you got under your desk. You know, you're like, what's happening here? Now we're seeing 1-1.5% on the euros. We're seeing the on euro versus dollar. We're seeing, of course, on a variety of currencies around the world moving so much. And the analogy that I brought to others was something like this, that, you know, if you're in a rowboat and you're in a river and you're stuck, and all of a sudden you have somebody coming to the rescue. So there's two of you in a rowboat, you're stuck, and all of a sudden this big elephant comes to rescue you. You're thinking, great. They have great size. They have great power. They're not going to get drowned because they're so tall. They're going to pull us out of the river. But what they end up doing is getting in the boat with you. Do you know what I'm saying?
That's a very good analogy. That's actually an excellent analogy.
And all of a sudden,
I was also going to use the analogy that basically, particularly for smaller countries, which a lot of the emerging markets are, it's like having a small boat and having a massive, great rescue craft coming towards you and tipping over your boat in the wake.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what it is. And the problem is that the movement and the amount of money that's being pulled and pushed into the market is playing havoc with currencies, and that is just not a good thing for markets around the world. Look at what happened with the yen. Why the yen is going up, I don't understand. Maybe you can explain that to me one day, because they are the one country with the most debt compared to any other country out there, and they have huge problems with deficit issues and all that, aging population, and extremely low rates. So why everybody's buying yens? Yen is it's extremely nutty to me. But nonetheless, they did that. The yen was 83, 82. I mean, ridiculous levels, and caused their exporters basically to say, hey, we can't make any money in an environment under 85. And intervention that came along that didn't help. And, you know, we're seeing country after country having to worry about this 600-pound gorilla, which is currency manipulation. How dare the U.S. say to China that they're currency manipulators when Bernanke is out there saying, okay, we're going to do this quantitative easing, but by the way, it has nothing to do with our dollar. And then Geithner coming out and saying, you know what, we have a strong dollar policy. You want to pull your hair out.
I think one of the funniest things about the strong dollar policy is in my entire working life, which is from the 70s, I've heard the strong dollar policy over and over again. And during that period, to give you some idea, the dollar-yen exchange rate has come from about 300 yen to the dollar to about 80. So if this is a strong dollar policy, I'd hate to see what a weak dollar policy would do.
It is the stupidest thing. Why do they say that? Honestly, why do they say
that?
I don't know.
But the thing that I think is most worrying, and you're absolutely correct about the currency volatility, is most businesses now operate on fairly skimpy margins. So they're operating on margins of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%. Now, if you're going to get movements of 1, 2% in the currency every day, the difference between making money and losing money is completely beyond your control, because you just cannot hedge those exposures, A, quickly enough, and B, even if you were to try to hedge those, the sheer cost of hedging those becomes punitive. And what you now do is see a very, very strange unintended consequence, which is in Asia, many, many companies have lost their shirts on currency derivatives. And you will recall a number of Central American companies in Mexico and also in Brazil basically went bankrupt in 2008, 2009 because of currency bets that they placed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not because I think they were inherently currency speculators, but given the fact that they were being exposed to this huge exposure from wild swings in the currency, they ended up becoming almost accidental currency speculators, and it bankrupted them. And this becomes hugely, hugely difficult to predict. And also for American investors, if I look at the McDonald's of the world, the IBMs of the world, which have huge, huge revenues from outside the United States, it's almost impossible to do earnings forecasts.
Yep.
Because the currency is moving 10 or 15% a month.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Let's finish it up with something I think you also know, of course. I mean, in your book, Traders, Guns, and Monies, you talk about a lot of the inside things that go on. Let's talk about inside, even though it's still being developed, the insider trading issue that is going to be obviously spreading out and getting into the details of who knew what, when did they do what, where did they get the information from, et cetera. Let's just ask you straight out. How much insider trading, or at least under the current titling and the current design and the current theory of what insider trading is, do you think that really goes on inside these major hedge funds?
Well, I think fundamentally everybody's looking for an edge, and if you're trading things where there's sensitive information, clearly that's a huge advantage. Now, the point is, how in heaven's name did you get it and did you use it? And the problem with insider trading always has been there is a level of it which goes on, and fundamentally the problem is that the regulators have trouble proving it, because the onus of proof is pretty hard. But I think this time around, we're seeing, obviously, and this is one of the joys of technology, is the audit trails, et cetera, with digitized information are far, far better. So under those circumstances, I think there is a real concern that there is a level of insider trading. And this is not new. I mean, we saw that in the internet bubble breakup, where there was a lot of insider trading going on. And that's what is the case again. But what is going to be interesting is whether we see the prosecutions. And there is a rather remarkable whiff of the end of the 1987 stock market bubble, which ended up with Drexels and all of those sorts of things. As Mark Twain once said, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it sure does rhyme.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see whether or not it's as bad as that time around. And it could be a nice coda to this era in one way.
I mean, it would be very nice if the edge, well, listen, everybody has an edge on something or other, but it'd be very nice a couple things. Insider trading to be lessened, we'll say that. I mean, I don't want to sound ignorant to the fact, obviously, you know, but at least it, you know, put to a point that you have to think twice by doing so, number one. Number two, the markets being so reliant on governmental initiatives, it would be nice to try to get a good degree of, I guess the best way you could call it is price discovery, which is very difficult when you have the governments manipulating things all over the place. You know, whether it's going to be something as simple as China trying to slow down the economic expansion, which would, you know, obviously is necessary in certain circumstances, but throws everything into a tizzy, or, you know, another round of quantitative easing, surprise this, surprise that, you know, new home buyers credit or whatever else it may be. It would be nice to go back to a more simple time when it was kind of, you know.
I think you're absolutely right, because one of the fundamental problems in this particular period of history we're living through is if all investors, this is ordinary investors who have their pension monies in the stock market or in financial assets, basically get discouraged that the whole game is rigged and basically completely out of control. I mean, they've lost confidence of the banks, they lose control and confidence of the stock market and the bond markets because people are manipulating it. Well, that creates a completely different environment of how you actually basically save. And, you know, having people keep all their money in their mattresses, I thought was an era of the past. I hope we don't go back that far into the past.
Well, at least it's not going to be in New York with all the bed bugs that are infestations they have there.
Do they eat the money? That's the next question.
I don't know. I heard there's some really cool ways to you put some, like, dry ice on the ground underneath your bed, and the bed bugs go to there. It's a major problem in New York. And maybe, I don't think they eat the money probably, but they sure are annoying from what I understand. And then the other problem is, though, that you could see, by the way, to answer your question, you know, you hope this doesn't discourage and all that. Of course it has. You could see that just in the daily volume of trading. The daily
volume, it's just down substantially.
Yeah.
It's down substantially. And it's not just a holiday effect or anything. It's just sustained. It's about half of what it used to be.
Yeah. I mean, there was a time that it was this level also, then it brought up a bit, then it went down. Listen, always a fascinating discussion with you, Das. I encourage you to get his book over on Amazon, Traders, Guns, and Money. Fully revised just recently. Great story, great discussion of the inside of what happens in a lot of the different markets, but I think it's a very good, an excellent read, actually. And it reads more like a crime drama, I guess we could call it, in a way. It gives you a lot of facts, fact-based issues as well. And, of course, where else can they find you, Das?
Well, they can find me whenever I talk to you. Isn't that the best place to find me?
We keep them in the outback with a bunch of Aborigines otherwise, right?
That's exactly right, because it's safer. It's just much safer
to be
out there. Besides, they're hunter-gatherers. So if all end ends, I'll be fed.
It's safer to be with cannibals these days, I got to tell you.
That's right, as long as you're not the other side of the cannibal.
Exactly. All right, we'll talk to you real soon. Das, thank you so much for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
It's my great pleasure, Andrew. Best of luck.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. Well, that wraps up another, I think, very insightful and thought-provoking conversation and episode of The Disciplined Investor. Of course, finding out more about the things that we write during the week, we put up a great piece, I thought, at the end of last week that you can go and find over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It's our entire series of employment data, looking at the JOLTS, looking at the unemployment rates, looking at the non-farm payrolls compared to the ADP, taking a look at hiring issues, the real unemployment rate, the U6, all that is on there. It's like 6 or 7 pages. Just go over there and check it out. And I think we entitled it The Ugly Unemployment Number because, of course, we know that Friday was a little ugly. But the markets didn't seem to care, so that's okay. We have all sorts of special things going to happen and plan for the new year, by the way. I hope you can enjoy a great maybe respite over the holiday season, which is fast approaching us, and thinking about what you're going to be doing and planning for next year. If you've gotten to the point where you realize that that money sitting on the side is not doing what you want it to do, consider that we invest money for our clients, and it's a great time towards the end of the year to start thinking about doing something for the beginning of 2011. All you have to do is check it out over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We have a 14-minute video, just a quick video to check out what's going on, how we do what we do, how we do the trading, the transparency that's involved. If you've been procrastinating, now's the time to take action. Don't wait until next year, maybe when it's too late. Until then, I'll see you soon. I look forward to seeing you next week. Have a great Hanukkah for those of you who are studying and worshiping and celebrating that particular holiday. And for the rest of us out there and rest of you out there, have a great weekend and a week ahead. We'll be back real soon with not only DH Unplugged, the winning investor, but of course, the Disciplined Investor. On a last note, go over to Podcast Awards and vote for the Disciplined Investor. We are in the running for one of the top business podcasts, podcastawards.com. You'll go over there, just pop in the Disciplined Investor. You'll see where it is and vote for us. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.